told everybody I was going to talk about some pigs. We'll get to that in a little bit. But you're thinking, what's that? What do pigs have to do with unleavened bread? Well, there's no leavening in them, you know, for starters. But I'm a simple person, and things have to make sense to me. You know, there's got to be some logic there. I try and work things through and think things out. And not only that, I left my pen up there. I borrow yours? Okay. Not only that, don't let me forget. I want to know how they apply in my life, and I want to understand what I'm doing. If it's possible, I want to try and understand it. And, you know, different people think different ways, but, you know, I really want it to make sense. Don't come in and give me some convoluted, you know, theoretical, show me how that's got some meaning for me. So I'm hoping that maybe some of that stuff will ring a chord with some people. I really struggled on what I should talk about today. And people think, well, whatever you think. I said, no, I do praying. And some years, like there was one year I was so happy to see Frank. Because you know, I didn't know if anybody else was coming that would give a message.
One year? You were glad to see Frank.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true, but... But he understood what I was talking about. Because I know he's been at Peace Sites where he's, you know, day after day after day. And if that's what God wants, that's fine. But I don't need to get up here and talk for my ego. I really don't. If I had my choice, I'd be sitting in the back somewhere just being quiet. And I thought, well, there's enough people here, I might only get one chance to speak, so I better make sure it's the right thing. So I better do some extra praying and make sure, well, what am I supposed to talk about? Because traditionally, since the day, and some people have started earlier, that's fine, but I'm just going to talk about what's from my viewpoint. If you can relate to that, that's cool. Since the day of unleavened bread starts tonight at sundown, for me anyway, normally you'd gear sermons and talk about unleavened bread and leavening and sin and the correlation between that, and which is really good, and this thing, and it's good to do. And I thought, you know, there's people here this year that have never kept the days of unleavened bread, never. And there's others here that have maybe kept it, but they've never done it for the entire time. They just come on the two high days and give a check and then go home and go to work and whatever, which is a good start. You know, that's what we did years ago. But they need to hear that. They really do. And everybody else needs to hear it as a reminder. But I thought, you know, it's a pretty safe bet that somebody's going to talk about this. Because it is the days of unleavened bread and Passover. So what am I supposed to do? You know, we normally, like I said, you talk about Jesus and what he did for us and how he gave his life for our sins, which is extremely important. Because if you don't understand that, nothing else really matters. You know what you're doing? You're playing church. And there's a whole world of people out there, including Sabbath keepers. I'm not just, you know, all those pagans. And Sabbath keeping communities are full of people that are playing church. And they're wasting their time. We need to know what he did for us, what God did for us with his son. And these things are all extremely important. So what are you going to talk about? You get an opportunity and you get people and maybe they've never heard it. They've only been to a Baptist church in the past, or maybe they haven't been to any church, or what do you do? So really, you know, this kind of things I'm thinking the last couple of weeks. And then I'd get an idea and I'd say, yeah, that sounds pretty good. And so I'd take a few notes so I wouldn't forget, because when stuff starts popping in my head, I gotta you know, write things down. So I can go back and find the verses. And where's Jenny? Jenny, I gotta find the addresses. You didn't think I was listening, but I was. But one of the things I want everybody to realize is what leavening is. And this is probably the only thing I'm going to talk about leavening today, so please listen up. We were blessed. I was blessed to have a mentor, and a lot of you knew him. His name is Charles Kimbrell. Now, Charlie he led kind of a unique life. One of the things he did, you know, he started out washing pans for Campbell Taggart Bakery. Now, if you'd never heard of Campbell Taggart Bakery, as a young man, teenager, late 19s, early 20s, something like that, Campbell Taggart owns places like, and this doesn't make them great, they kill millions of people, but they own places like Dolly Madison, you know. And, yeah, you know, so they've got bakeries where they bake bread and things like that. One of their customers was McDonald's. Well, Charles ended up as the president of Campbell Taggart Bakeries. And he knew everything about it. And when I met him, he had actually come to Knoxville because there was a bakery, a family-owned bakery, and they were having all kinds of problems. And he had retired at that point, but he was doing consulting, and they hired him to come in because other people told me just about Charlie. He never told me, but he could walk in the bakery. This is what he liked to do. Instead of coming into the front office and sitting down, and he said, let me just go back there and walk around. And he'd smell, and he'd listen for the equipment, and he knew every aspect of it, and he could figure out what they were doing wrong. Now, one of Campbell Taggart's customers was this little outfit called McDonald's. Yeah. Charlie's got some stories about Ray Kroc and all of this. Ray Kroc eventually hired him away from Campbell Taggart, made him a executive vice president for McDonald's, and he built all of the McDonald's bakeries, like 7 of them in the U.S. He retired when they said, we want you to go to Russia and build a bakery there. But anyway, the reason I went through all of that is he knew a little bit about baking, and when you do, you make bread and buns and, oh, one thing I forgot, you know why McDonald's doesn't have lard in their buns? Because Charlie took it out. When he started keeping the Sabbath and the holy days, he joined Worldwide Church of God. And he's got stories about McDonald's. People don't know this, but, you know, Ray Kroc borrowed his money to get McDonald's going from the mafia. And the mafia, what they do is they set up businesses, and that's how they funnel money through all the businesses. And every time Charlie wanted to change a supplier or do something, that's family. And he knew what that meant. It was, no, this is where we buy this from because that's family. So it's the Chicago Mafia because they were headquartered out of Chicago, I think it was. But anyway, one day he pulls the lard out of all of their buns and puts in beef tallow instead. And when Ray Kroc found out about that, a year or two later, he was livid. And he said, what do you mean? You change that recipe without running it past all of us and going through everything. And he says, where do you think that original recipe came from? I'm the one that formulated it when I was running Campbell Taggart. He says, you told me you wanted me to build your bakeries and increase your profits and increase your scalability and increase your quality, and he says, then I did. He says, have you had anybody complain for the last 2 years about your buns? I think somewhere I've got some recordings, but I wish I could find them because he did the best job I've ever heard anybody do on leavening and what it does. Okay? Now I want to step on toes, and we respect everybody's beliefs, but there's people that say, well, it's things that puff up, like don't whip eggs because that can puff it up. And I know worldwide, a lot of this come from them, what I'm going to get into next, like the baking soda and the baking powder. If you read a label, it'll say leavening agent, and it'll list, you know, sodium bicarbonate or whatever the different things are. But he explained early on, because there was one year I told everybody, you know, at least in my family, we were having, I think we were going to Big Ridge or someplace like that. Maybe it was even before we started doing it all the days. And I was looking at the labels on dog food. And I knew it was, you know, leavening puffs things up because they had been, that's what they had taught me and everything. And I told our family, I says, no soda, no soda, because that's full of gas and bubbles and, you know, it puffs it all up, just pop the bottle or the can or whatever. And so there was one year that for our family, at least, you know, soda was bad. Now, that was a good start. Maybe not for the reasoning on the leavening thing, but, you know, it was a good start to get rid of that concoction. But what leavening actually does, what the yeast spores do, is when they get into something like this, just talk about dough, all right? First, leavening is everywhere. If you think that you have cleaned out your house and everything, got rid of it, guess you forgot something somewhere. You're going to go home and find it. And I'm not going to go through and, you know, do what people normally do. Well, did you clean the toaster, the oven, the vacuum cleaner after you vacuumed it all up? But it's in the air. Even if you were successful on getting rid of it all out of your house, it's still in the air. It's invisible. It's everywhere. You can't get rid of it, and it's just like sin. But even going farther than that, I believe that's why God chose this as a symbol. And yes, leavening in the Bible, sometimes it talks about, you know, sin and the correlation between all of that. But what the yeast spores actually do in the dough is they cause it to ferment and rot. And in that fermentation process and in that rotting process, you get the bubbles coming up, and that's what causes the dough to rise. It corrupts it. It changes it. It rots it from the inside, and that's what sin does to us. It's everywhere. You think you're doing pretty good, and you're patting yourself on the back, and then all of a sudden, if you're really, really brave, get down on your knees and ask God to show you where you need to change yourself to be closer to Him, and then watch out.
Yeah.
Sin rots us from the inside and corrupts us from the inside and changes physically and spiritually the same thing like leavening does. And then there's medical aspects to it, and I'm not going to get into all of that stuff, but there's some very good medical reasons why God says at least once a year to get rid of it and put it all off. So that's the little introduction. I'm not going to talk about any of that stuff. I think that something else is very important that we all need to understand. And this has really been on my heart for years, but especially the last couple years. And as time is going on, it's more and more and more. So I got a weakness in that I actually care about people. I get a bad rap because I want to fix stuff. You know, men like to do that. I don't know if you're a man and you got any of those tendencies, ask your wife, you know, and she can tell you. But, you know, say a tree falls on the roof of your house, the first thing you're going to do is say, honey, get out there and put the tarp on the roof, right? She's going to say, oh, no, what are we going to do? And you're going to be out there and say, where's the flashlight? Where's my hammer? Where's the nail? Where's the tarp? Where's the, you know, you're going to go out there. You're going to fix it. So when I see stuff, and it makes sense, I just want to, it's like, why all of the monkeying around and the, here's the problem, here's the solution, let's just fix it. And sometimes if you got a hammer, everything looks like a nail, you know? So you just want to fix it. And when people see me doing this, it's like, oh, he must be in a bad mood. He must not. No, it's like, I'm concentrating on this. We need to fix it. Let's just take care of it. And then they think, I remember when Emily was born and the first time one of the women from the congregation saw me holding her. It was like 3 months later, we get to take her home from the hospital. And when she was born, she was only 1 pound, 12 or 13 ounces, something like that. So, and they said, she said, told some of the other women, she says, look at him with that little baby. Well, she wasn't the only grandchild we had, but she was really special because they told us she wasn't going to make it. Mary got really mad, and she says, you don't know who God is. But I want to look at some of the things that happened 3,500 years ago because that's appropriate to do at this time of year with the Exodus and Passover and all of those. But I'm going to look at them in a way that I really haven't heard that much about in the past. And the reason I want to look at that, and it is timely to look at what happened in the Bible, because I see the same kinds of things happening today. And it's getting worse as we're going on. And we know that in the future, the Bible talks about a future Exodus. And one of the quote part of it, it talks about, no longer shall they say when the Lord our God who brought us out of the land of Egypt. It's talking about a future Exodus and a future Passover. And it's so big, the original one, people aren't even talking about it. But to get from here to there, there's a lot of territory to be covered. And I see some things going on that my heart really does go out for people because it's like I think they're just walking around and they don't have a clue. And I know they got a relationship with God and I know and I can't fix it. No matter, it's impossible. I can't even get them to listen so that they can fix it themselves. But I think that everything that is happening today is happening. And by the way, it's right on schedule with God's timeline. Okay? The things are happening at the right time in the right place. And everybody gets all nervous. Some people are getting really nervous. And, you know, it's not as bad as Y2K was for those that were really listening and preparing and putting things away. You know, right before Y2K, we ordered a semi-truck load. We called one of the long-term food places and said, you know, we want to place an order. And they said, okay, well, we can ship. And this was like end of October. We had just got back from the feast. And they said, well, we can ship in like June or July of next year. And I said, what good is that going to do? You know, we won't need it by then. So I says, what do we got to do? Pay extra? Pay double? No, sir. Everybody is first come, first serve, and we'll put your name in, and we won't charge your credit card until we actually ship. And so I says, all right. How much do I have to order? And the amount was a semi-truck load. Oh, one semi, 40-foot trailer. Wow. So I says, let me call you back. I got on the phone and I started calling people I knew and I said, you know, we can, there was a family in the congregation, they had they were manufactured stone. So they had shipping docks and fork trucks and all of this. And so we had it delivered there and then we all showed up and there was like 30 of us that showed up and everybody pulled their cars up and loaded them up and we went home and, you know, so it hasn't got, I don't have a semi-truck load of food around my house, but, and I don't know anybody else has done that, but I do know some people that are are saying, what's going to happen? You know, are we closer to the tribulation? What are we going to do? And then I see, I'm shocked that people are actually standing up to Big Brother and the government and saying no. And of all places that really got a start big was Canada. I couldn't believe that Canada told the government where to go. The people in Canada, a lot of them, and they don't have the same constitution that we do, and you know, a lot of the same rights, at least that they tell us that we still have until they start taking away. But I'll get off on all of that. But everything's on the right timeline and everything's on schedule. But I think that there's some people are going to have some hard times in the future with the economy. With before we get to the mark of the beast and you can't buy or sell, I think that myself, that this economy is going down the toilet in this country before we ever get to that point. But we all know the story about Joseph and the 7 years of plenty. Somehow I hit that mouse. I didn't mean to jump there yet. But the 7 years of plenty and then the 7 years of famine and how Pharaoh had the dream and Joseph interpreted it and he used that to put Joseph in a position of authority to basically save a huge part of the world. Israel specifically, but Egypt would have been dead too. So I want to talk about what happened there. An aspect that people don't really think that much about, maybe. At least I haven't heard a lot of sermons about this. In Genesis 41:28, it says, this is the thing that I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of plenty will come through all the land of Egypt, but after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. So in other words, it's going to be so bad that you're going to forget all of the good years that you had before this. It's going to be really bad. And the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe. Verse 32. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice because the thing is established by God and God will shortly bring it to pass. Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this and let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh. And let them keep food in the cities. Then the food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. So, and then Joseph believed the interpretation and appointed, Pharaoh believed the interpretation and appointed Joseph, and this is what he did. But one thing that I have noticed is, you know, I've been riding high, and I've been live paycheck to paycheck, and I've been dirt poor and broke and having to go down to a food bank because there was no food in the house. So I've, you know, been to the different aspects of this, but when people, let's just take easy numbers to think about. And smaller numbers because they're bigger than this today. But if you make $10,000 a year, how much a year do you spend? $10,000. If you're making $50,000 a year, how much a year do you spend? I remember in 1986 when we moved to Tennessee, I had a company and Martin Marietta bought part of it. We paid ourselves, me and my partner, we paid ourselves $50,000 a year. And in 1986, that was some pretty good money. But you know what? We spent every penny of it. It was gone. And it was at that point I figured out, you know, hey, there's really some nice houses around Tennessee. And I says, all of these nice houses, wonder where all of these people are working. And then I figured out that a lot of them, mom and dad are both working. And they got a couple new cars in the driveway, but they don't own them. The bank does. And they got a nice fancy house, but they don't own it. The bank does. They got an equitable interest. As long as they pay their ransom to the bank every month, the bank will let them stay there. But if you make $200,000 a year, how much are you spending?
$200,000.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But see, we all do this. And sometimes if you're making $50,000 a year, you got to live like you're making $25,000 a year. And I won't even get into any of that and some of the reasons why. But we're blessed in this country. We really are. Because even poor people in this country, and I've been one of them more than once, they live like a king compared to people in other countries. There's things out there for them. And if you don't qualify for any of the government freebies and handouts, there's food banks from the churches and all kinds of stuff. Unless you're really lazy, and I'm not including people that have mental problems, because they're the ones that should be taken care of. Not the ones that are lazy and just looking for a way to scam the system, and they won't work. And God does talk about that. If you don't provide for your family, you're worse than an infidel. But there's an evil plan that's been going on for 100 years now. Now, there's been an evil plan for a long time, but it really started getting root in this country actually about 100 years ago, and starting 89 years ago, it was shifted into high gear, and the pedal is to the metal. And now it's going even worse, because it's like we're going downhill. You know, if your car is, you got it floored and you're just flat out on some flat land in the middle of Indiana or something, and your car does X amount of miles an hour, you start going down a hill and you'll pick up some speed. And we're going down the hill, we're going to crash at the bottom. We're in free fall. But I don't want to talk about the economy today. I'm just talking about this plan that's out there. And what's that got to do with unleavened bread? But first, I want to look at Joseph a little bit. I want to look at what happened in the first year of the famine. Okay? I want to turn to Genesis chapter 47, verse 13. We've all read this multiple times, but have you ever really read it and stopped and thought about what it said? Hopefully some of you have. But it said, "Now there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money," not part of it, not some of it, not most of it, "Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house." The very first year, all of the money was gone. Now, what happens if all of the money was, the banks called in all of the notes and all of the money that was out there, and they said, "Everybody bring everything you have in." Well, they've already got it for most of us anyhow. But you had to bring, say people actually walked around with cash in their pockets and they hid it under their mattress and they buried some of it in their backyard. And all of that money was sucked out of the economy and it all went into Biden's storehouse. Okay? What would happen to this country? That's what happened to Egypt the very first year. And now we probably can't even imagine what it would be like, because we've never experienced anything like this.
So he took in all the money and bought the grain with it?
All of the people, they had no food. So they came to Joseph, "Feed us." And Joseph says, "Yep, bring your money in and we'll sell you the grain." What did Joseph's family do? They didn't come down there and say, "Where's the form? Can we apply for food stamps, WIC, and SNAP? No. It's like, we got the food. Let me read it again. It's up there. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought. It means even the Egyptians, you were an Egyptian citizen, you were hungry, you had to go down to Joseph and buy your grain out of Pharaoh's storehouse. And it took everything. Now, you think there was some inflation going on? That doesn't talk, but just realistically think about this. Get logical. You think there, if a bushel of grain went, I don't know what their currency actually was, but let's just talk for U.S. money. If it was $10 a bushel, in the 7 years of plenty, do you think when there was famine and there was none that it was $10 a bushel? I don't believe so. First time there's a storm in the Gulf somewhere and it wipes out some houses, go down to Home Depot and look what they've done to the plywood. You know, it triples overnight. That's year one. Let's take a look. Year two is up there. Genesis 47:15. So when the money had failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, the economy crashed. Why? Because the only money that was out there all went to Pharaoh for grain, for food. What if you wanted to pay somebody to help you move, pack up and move and buy a bigger house, or, you know, you wanted a new chariot? You know, Ben's chariots was out there and he had a special on his chariots, and you wanted to keep up with the Joneses, and none of that happened. It was food or die. We think about, well, okay, it was all of the people surrounding Egypt and all, he got all their money, and it was the Egyptians too. Year two. So when the money had failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians, who's coming? All the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed. They don't have money, in other words, to buy more in the second year. Pharaoh got it all in the first year. Every year we're supposed to go through this story. And it's supposed to teach us multiple things. Don't raise your hand. Don't answer. Have you ever learned this lesson going through this before? There's people in here that have been keeping Passover for a long, decades and decades and decades. Now, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe the Bible doesn't say this. Maybe we're not supposed to learn anything about this. Or maybe we're supposed to learn things that happened in the Bible so we can save ourselves from ourselves. Verse 16. So Joseph said, give you me your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money's gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the cattle of the herds, for the donkeys. And thus he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. Some of it, part of it, the majority of it, all. Now the only other food that they got besides bread is meat. But see, there's a problem. What are you going to feed your livestock? Oh man, who's going to eat? Us or the livestock? Give me all your livestock and I'll give you some more bread. Not cakes and pastries and, you know, bread. How desperate were they? Enough that they would give up everything they had. That's year two. Guess how many years are we looking at here? Seven? And we're in year two, and Pharaoh's got all of the money and all of the livestock and everything else that the Egyptians own. Let's look at year three. Click the page. 47:18, Genesis 47:18. When that year had ended, year two, so year two is over now, you're going to start year three. When that year had ended, they came to him the next year, the beginning of year three, and said to him, "We will not hide from my Lord that our money is gone. My Lord also has our herds of livestock. There's nothing left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and our land will be we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, and the land may not be desolate." Then Joseph bought all of the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For every man of the Egyptians sold his field, every. Everybody catch that? And the Egyptians, every man of the Egyptians sold his field because of the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's, and as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end. It took 3 years for Pharaoh to have all of the money, all of the livestock, all of the land. We all think, or most people think, that it was just Israel that eventually became slaves. The slavery part for Israel came later, after Joseph was dead, after Pharaoh was dead. When they moved to Egypt, it was the Egyptians that were the slaves first. And Pharaoh had it all, and it took 3 years to do it. And, oh, there's still 4 years left. Does anybody got an idea what this might have to do with the days of unleavened bread? Well, why are people even going to really be interested? What other time of the year are you going to be interested in hearing about this other than, hey, this is what happened and this is what led up to the Exodus and this is where it all really started and here's how Israel got to the land. And I'm cutting a lot of it out, but I wanted to take some portions and say, let's look at this slightly different than we had maybe looked at it before. Anybody know how to boil a live frog? Here's a lot of people, most people know this. But if you were going to boil a live frog, yeah, Brian says, a little at a time. If you throw the frog into the hot pan of water, it's jumping out. But you put them in some nice, comfortable water, and then you turn the stove on, and you start heating the water up. Everybody knows this story. I'm not telling you anything new. And it gets warmer and warmer and warmer. That's how you're going to boil a frog. So, yeah, frogs were one of the plagues in Egypt, but I'm not going to talk about frogs. But I want you to think about that analogy for a second. I want to tell you a story. I told the kids I was going to talk about pigs. I want to tell you a story, a true story, about a herd of about 3,000 wild hogs. Now, they made a movie called Wild Hogs, but it's got nothing to do with that. This is an actual true story about roughly 3,000 wild hogs that were in the Okefenokee Swamp in Georgia. And that's down by the border between Georgia and Florida. About the time of the Civil War, some pigs got loose close to the swamp, and they ended up going into the swamp, and nobody really cared much about it. We had this thing going on called the Civil War and battles, and had other things on this country, had other things on its mind. So these pigs get down in there, and for over 100 years, they're just running around in this swamp, and a wild boar, wild hogs, they come from domesticated pigs. You just let them loose out in the wild, and they turn into these really kind of ferocious, vicious animals. And I've seen shows about people going out and hunting the wild hogs and killing them. But they're really something different. Nothing, a regular pig can be dangerous, but nothing like these guys. Now, after decades of being free and self-sufficient, this herd of hogs, something happened. To give you a little background. Somewhere around, I think it was 1830, there was a guy that was born, and his name was Jedediah Smith. And Jedediah had some interesting, had a little bit of an interesting career, but one of the things he did, and he was pretty good at, is he was a trapper. And in 1899, he's living in North Dakota, and he's got trap lines, and that's how he's making the majority of his money, his living. So he knew a little bit about trapping. Never been trapping wild hogs, but in 1899, he was 70 years old. And they say he was a pretty big guy. He was like 6'2", 6'4", stood out in a crowd. And he had an old Studebaker, what do they call it? Wagon. And a team of horses. And in 1899, he loads up his Studebaker wagon with some of his possessions and supplies and traps and gets his team of horses and he hooks them to the Studebaker wagon. And he had heard about these wild hogs. And he knew that if he could trap them, they'd be worth about $10 apiece. 3,000 hogs, that's $30,000. And in 1899, that is a lot of money. So he starts heading down to the Okefenokee Swamp in Georgia. That's all he knows is all of these stories that, you know, the trappers talk about it, the hunters talk about it, and people talk about it. And like stories go, everybody that passes it on, it grows just a little bit, and they expand on it. And so he's just, you know, there were some people claiming there was as many as 30 or 40,000 hogs down there. But when he got down there, there was about 3,000. So he stopped in January of 1900 in a small town just north of the Okefenokee Swamp in Georgia, southern part of Georgia. And he walks into the general store. And sitting around their pot-bellied stove, there were seven or eight of the town's local citizens, and they were out there discussing how they're going to solve all the problems of the world and all these things. And they look up, and they see this guy, and they know he ain't from around there. Okay? Anybody in the South, if you're from the North and you move to the South, one of the first things you hear is, y'all ain't from around here, are you? But Jedediah asked if anybody could direct him to the Okefenokee Swamp. And the old-timers looked at him like he's crazy. You know, he's a big guy, but he's 70 years old, so he's getting on in his years. He wants to go into that swamp. They said, y'all must be a stranger in these parts. He said, I'm from North Dakota. They told him, well, in that Okefenokee Swamp, there's thousands of wild hogs in there. A man that goes into that swamp by himself don't come out. It's happened. They go in there and we never see them again. And those that venture a little bit in there, they lose an arm. If the hogs don't grab them, and drag them in there and eat them, they'll lose an arm. There's people lost a leg. There's people that are mangled up for life, barely survived with their life. You don't understand, fella. You can't go in there hunting them hogs. Because I asked him, what are you going to do? He says, well, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to find them hogs. And I'm going to capture them. He says, you're crazy. It don't work like that. I don't know what they do up in North Dakota, but it don't work like that down here. He says, you're going to die. So they try and talk him out of it, but he's just traveled a whole long way. And they tell him the stories about, like I said, the legs get chewed off, the arms get bit off. They said, these pigs have been free since the revolution for over 100 years. And they're out there eating snakes and rooting out the roots, and they've been feeding themselves for over 100 years. How are you going to go in there and trap them? They're wild and they're dangerous. You can't trap them, and nobody dares go into that swamp by himself. And it's only you. Man, you're insane. And they all nod their head in agreement. But this guy, Jedediah, he ain't taking no for an answer. He's traveled all this way, and he's thinking about that $10 a head for each hog that he can trap. He says, told them, he thanked them for the warning and said, now could you please direct me to the swamp? They said, oh yeah, it's due south, but we ain't taking you. So he, while he was there at the store, he purchased 5 tons of corn. And he asked the storekeeper if they could help him load it in his wagon. So he loads up the wagon, he pays them, and he drives down the road in his Studebaker wagon with his team of horses and 5 tons of corn in the back of the behind him. 2 months later, you know, they're all talking about, wonder what ever happened to that old crazy guy. 2 months later, he comes back into town with his wagon empty. Now it's March. Pulls up to the general store. He gets down off of the wagon. He walks in and he tells him, he says, I need 5 more tons of corn. After getting help loading it up, he goes back to the wagon and drives down the road to the swamp. 2 months later, guess what happens? Comes back again. Every 2 months, he's back to the same little country store and he's buying 5 more tons of corn. And they start talking. You know, what is this guy, some kind of devil? Where he goes in there with a wagon loaded with corn and these pigs don't kill him and eat all of his corn. And he keeps coming back every couple months and he's buying. He's got to be have the devil inside of him to protect him from them hogs in the story. Every 2 months, he's back. And people can't figure out why is it that he can go down there and disappear in that swamp, and he comes back and he ain't even bit by a hog, much less killed. In November, Jedekiah comes back to town, comes into the store, and the storekeeper says, I bet you need 5 more tons of corn, right? He says, no, I need to hire about 50 wagons. I have 3,000 hogs out there in the swamp penned up, and they're hungry, and they're squealing, and they're mad, and I've got to get them to the market right away, or they're going to starve to death. He said, what? You got to be kidding. In the swamp? Doki Fanoki Swamp? Yep, I got them all penned up out there. They haven't eaten for 2 days. And they're really hungry and squealing and crying. And if I don't get back there and get them loaded up and get them to the market, I'll lose everything and all my work that I've done. So one of the old timers says to him, you mean you've captured the wild hogs of the Okefenokee Swamp? He says, yep, sure have. I need 50 wagons and 50 men. I said, well, how did you do that? He says, well, the first week I went out there and they were wild, all right. I didn't dare go into that swamp, but I went right up to the edge of it and I drove my wagon through there and I started dumping some corn out the back of it right at the edge of the swamp. And they were all hiding in the undergrowth and in the thorns and bushes and shrubbery, and they were watching me, what I was doing, trying to decide what they were going to do with me. None of them had come out. I didn't dare get off that wagon. But every day I'd come back and I'd spread a sack of corn. And the old pigs wouldn't have nothing to do with it. They'd just watch me. But the younger pigs decided that it was easier to eat the free corn than it was to go out and dig out roots and eat snakes and chase them down and capture them. So the youngest of them began to eat the corn first. And I just kept this up. I did this every single day. And pretty soon even the old pigs decided that it was easier to eat the free corn. So they started coming out after I had spread it at the edge of the swamp, and they come out and ate their free corn. After all, they could run off in any direction they wanted to. And they saw I wasn't no threat to them because I did this day after day and nothing ever happened to the young ones. And the old ones, pretty soon they let their guard down and they started eating the corn too. The next thing was I had to get them used to eating in the same place all of the time. So I went into the swamp a little ways, and there was a clearing, and I started dumping the corn on the ground in that clearing in the swamp. And they'd stand at the edge of the clearing, and they'd watch me, and I'd dump the corn, and then I'd ride off with my horses, and after I was out of sight, they'd come out, and they'd eat all the free corn that they wanted. It was wide open, it was safe for them, and if I started to come back, they could just take off running, and they'd be safe and free. They could still stable or subsidize their diets with roots and snakes if it was an easy picking, or a snake was, you know, just out there sunning itself or whatever. They could always, if they wanted to, but that corn was pretty tasty. That was like a real treat for them. After a while, I started digging some holes, and I just put up some fence posts till I had fence posts all around the clearing in the swamp. And they'd just walk past the fence posts, and they'd look at them, and they were a little fearful at first when I first started. But by the time I got all the way around the swamp, they were used to those fence posts, and it didn't stop them from nothing. They could walk in, they could walk out. It wasn't no problem. They're just sticks coming up out of the ground. Wasn't that big of a thing. And the corn was there every single day for them. This went on for about 2 weeks. And they started to get real used to just walking past the fence posts to get their free corn. Then I started laying the bottom rail to the fence. And they didn't want anything to do with that. Where I started laying the rails, they'd walk over and walk between a couple fence posts that didn't have any. But after a while, they got used to that. And the young ones could just jump right over, and the older ones just stepped right over it, and there's the corn, they could see it. So they just hop over to a fence post, even when I had it all the way around the swamp. They just jump right over. Says, I left two big openings. Says, then I laid the second rail for the fence. Now the little ones couldn't jump over that, and the older ones thought it was just easier to walk through these two big openings by the time I got two rails all the way around the swamp. And there was one in each direction. So they got used to just walking in through these two openings and leaving whichever way they wanted to leave. It wasn't any threat to their freedom or their independence. They can always run away and go out the entrance or the exit. And then I began to feed them every other day. They got used to eating that free corn every single day, but I started cutting them back, and every other day I'd start to feed them. And they'd squeal, and they'd grunt, and they'd beg, and they'd come in there on the days I wasn't feeding them, and they'd come into that clearing, and they'd run around and cry and caused a commotion. I wanted them to get a little hungry. Cut back on them a little bit. Now the pigs started getting more and more desperate for food because their bellies were hungry or empty every other day. And they had stopped going out digging for roots and hunting snakes and feeding themselves, so they were getting pretty dependent on my free corn here. They needed me. Then I put up the third rail around the fence. And now even the young adults, and they couldn't get over those two over the third rail if they were able to get over the second rail. Now there's no way. They can't get in. There's only two places for everybody to get in and get out. So they got used to that, and they'd run in and out whenever they felt like it. And then I put up the fourth rail just to make sure. Then I built a gate. And I closed that gate after it was done on one end of the field. So now they all knew, well, they had to walk around to the other end of the field, and that's where they could come in and eat and leave when they were done. They get used to that. Then one day I went in there, dumped a bunch of corn on that middle of that field, stepped back, got out of the way where I could still see what's going on, but I was far enough away. I wasn't no threat to them. So they all went running in there to eat that free corn. And while they're all in there eating the free corn, I snuck back up and I shut that gate. He says, now they're trapped. And now I'm here and I need to hire 50 wagons or my hogs are all going to die. I need to get those pigs to the market before they starve to death. Well, what's that got to do with the days of unleavened bread? I just showed you what happened with Israel, with Pharaoh. See, the free corn is our liberty here in this country. And the government is oh so happy to hand out the free corn. And yeah, it's not their corn. They steal it from some and give it to others. But they're not just so benevolent that they just feel generous. They got an agenda. There's something that they're after. And by the time this country wakes up and figures out what that there might be this agenda and they can't be trusted, it's going to be too late. The free corn has been reduced the free people that were once in this country self-reliant and independent and could fend for themselves. And even if they didn't live on a farm, if they lived in a city somewhere, especially after the Depression, because there were people in my family that I would say, what do you got all this food for? What are you doing? Say, you don't understand. I lived through the Depression. And there are very few people that can talk about that anymore. And there's generations, multiple, of people that think, well, they're old fools. Everybody knows you just go down to Walmart or Kroger or whatever, and there's all the food on them shelves that you'd ever need. Go down, who's been down to Walmart, Kroger's, Food City, or wherever it is that you go, wherever you live, and looked at the prices on those shelves lately?
Sometimes there's whole sections that don't have nothing on.
Right? And sometimes they're empty.
Yeah.
Supply chain disruptions. Used to be that I didn't realize this until this last month. See, I grew up in farm country in Wisconsin, and you'd hear about that the Midwest was the breadbasket of the world. And I still thought, well, and we're producing enough to feed ourselves and other countries too. And no, Frank shaking his head, no. You know where most of the grain comes from in the world today?
Ukraine
and Russia.
And then
80% of the world's supply is Ukraine and Russia. Well, yeah, and the fertilizer mainly that because they don't keep the land Sabbath, so you got to have fertilizer to grow things. And right now, China is out buying up all the grain, the wheat, as we speak. Everything that's available, they've purchased it in hundreds of tons. If it's out there in Europe, anywhere, they're buying it all up. But I don't even want to get off on all of that today. I want to talk about something a little bit different that affects, I would guess that it would affect every person in this room. And if it's not affecting you today, right now, it's affected you big time in the past. And unfortunately, it will affect a lot of people in the future. And that's this word that we call usury. Okay? A lot of people don't think that the Bible has a whole lot to say about money. That's not accurate. That's not true. There are over 700 verses in the Bible that deal directly with money, where that is the subject. Not as an offhanded thing. I mean, it's talking about money and finances over 700 times in the Bible. And we all squirm when we talk about this. I want to look at it today. Let me just say, from a biblical viewpoint, it's an evil sin. Let's examine what the Bible says about usury itself, all right? I've got the... let me get it up there. Strong's 5391, Neshach. It's a primitive root to strike with a sting as a serpent. Figuratively, to oppress with interest on a loan. To bite, to lend upon usury. Interest on a debt. Take a Hebrew word that means to bite, to sting, to destroy. That's what usury is, okay? Now, the Bible forbids us from charging God's people usury. And I think most people understand that. So let's take a look at it. Leviticus 25:35 says, if one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner that he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him. But fear your God that your brother may live with you, and you shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food for a profit. I've got some. This is, if somebody is a brother or a sister and they're living among you, you lend them money. Now, they come to you and they say, Brian, I need to borrow $10,000 because I want to take Mary and the two girls and their families to Hawaii. We've never been to Hawaii. Can you borrow me some money? Just not talking about something like that. Or, you know, my van out there. See that old white Ford van out there? There's like 307,000 miles on that thing. I've been looking at one of those Sprinter diesel vans, you know, about $80,000. And I really need it. And I want it, and I use it 95% of the time for God, so this is really for him. Brian, can you just write me a check? I think I'd probably come up with about $5,000 if I tried really hard. Can you write me a check for
$85,000? I
can write you a check for $85,000. Oh, and by the way, you can't charge me usury on it because we're brothers. No, it's not talking about that. It's not talking about that. This is for survival. Actual needs. Not wants, needs for survival. For brothers, sisters, their children. Let's look at another verse, Deuteronomy 28, verse 12. It tells us that lending can be a blessing. Okay? It says, the Lord will open to you his good treasure, the heavens, to give you rain to your land in its seasons, or season, and to bless all the work of your hand. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. Now, this is for the nation. This is the national law. He's saying, he told Israel, says, I'm going to bless you, and you're going to lend to multiple nations, but you shall not borrow. Now, about 7:45 or 8 o'clock this morning, I went out to a website, usdebtclock.org, and I did a screen capture. The United States is the biggest deadbeat nation in the entire world. We're at the top of the list. And what they admit to for the national debt a few hours ago was $30,390,130,062,612. And it was going so fast, I had to check and make sure I captured it right. It just wasn't a blur because you couldn't read the last two columns. They were spinning so quick. That's what they admit to. That's not the real debt, by the way. That doesn't cover any of the liabilities, things that they have deceived people with since for decades and decades, that I call social insecurity. Insecurity. And a crazy check. See, when we first came to Tennessee, there was a guy that his name was Roy, and he loved what he called barnyard buzzards. Went to his house, and I says, can we bring anything? He says, yeah, stop by the Colonel and pick up a bucket of them barnyard buzzards. Says, that's my favorite. Today it's called kidney failure and cancer. Stands the acronym for KFC. But he got to talk, and he had worked at Alcoa Aluminum Plant most of his adult life, and he had retired. And he was talking about his crazy check. He said it 3-4 times, and I said, Roy, what are you talking about, a crazy check? He said, well, all my life I worked there. I made good money. And they took part of that money every Friday out of my paycheck. And they told me, they said, this is going to go into Social Security, and then when you retire, you can get a retirement from Social Security. We're going to give you a monthly check and you can live off of it. He says, and I believed it. He says, if they think you can live off of that, they're crazy. That's why I call it my crazy check. But back to this. It doesn't include those liabilities. It's really at least 10 times the 30 trillion. It's like 300,000 trillion. But even if it was, if they weren't lying and it was just 30 trillion, it is impossible to ever climb out of that debt.
Because it wasn't designed.
Yeah, the banks, the usury system, and everything was designed to entrap us and pull us down into a bottomless pit and steal from us. So what's going on? Let's take a look at another verse. Ezekiel, chapter 22, verse 12. If you take bribes to shed blood, if you take usury and increase, you have made profit from your neighbors by extortion and have forgotten me, says the Lord God. Because usury is extortion. All right? How many people think that a 1% interest rate, you say, oh, you got to go. And today, interest is artificially low. But I remember in the 1980s, I was working at a factory, and I thought, man, I'm going to work here the rest of my life. It's a good pay, and it's an international company, and they paid really good. And I think, I'm just going to work here, put my 30 years in, and retire, and I'm all set. And then something in the 1980s happened that was called runaway inflation. Interest rates were up at one point to almost, if they weren't 20%, it was, you know, 18, 19, 20%. Our next door neighbors had bought their house about 10 years prior to this in the early 70s, and they had what's called an adjustable rate mortgage. And when interest went crazy, their home payment tripled from 1 month to another. And they couldn't afford their house payment. And they had put in, now unfortunately the way usury works is in 10 years you really haven't put a whole lot of money in. It all goes to interest, so you don't have a whole lot of principal, but they think, we've had this for 10 years and we're going to lose our house. We're going to lose everything we have. Well, I got laid off and from the factory, and but what if somebody would have come to them and said, somebody in their, they didn't go to church, but say they went to church and somebody in their church says, you know, I really want to help people in the church, so I'm going to give you the money to pay off that bank that's stealing from you, and I'm going to charge you 1% because we're brothers. People say, well, that's pretty generous. That's pretty Christian of this person that would do such a benevolent act. So think about 1%. What God thinks about even 1% interest or usury. In Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 1, says, and there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren. For there were those who said, we, our sons and our daughters are many. Therefore, let us get grain that we may eat and live. There were also those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and our vineyards. And now our flesh is the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And indeed, we are forcing our sons and our daughter to be slaves. So something's going on here. Something's going on with the economy. And they're complaining and rising up against it. And some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not in our power to redeem them. So they can't even go and redeem their own children. For other men have our lands and our vineyards. Well, wait a minute. How did they get a hold of the land, the vineyards, their children? They're slaves, they're bought and paid for. Let me see, was this Nehemiah, was this before or after the lesson in Egypt that we just read? It was after, right? Somebody didn't learn a lesson somewhere. Verse 6, and I became very angry when I heard their outcry and these words. It's up there, Nehemiah chapter 5. Okay? She says, this is not right. Nehemiah is highly upset. This is wrong. They have taken their lands, their children, their property, everything, and stole it from them, basically. And the people are upset, and they're crying out, asking for help. So continuing on, Nehemiah 5, verse 7, after serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and the rulers and said to them, each of you is extracting usury from his brother. They had the Torah, they had the law, they knew that it wasn't allowed, but they were charging it and doing it. So I called a great assembly against them, and I said to them, according to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brethren who were sold to the nations. So now they're being sold off as slaves to other nations even. Now indeed, will you even sell your brethren, or should they be sold to us? Then they were silenced and found nothing to say. Verse 9, then I said, what are you doing? What you're doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because the reproach of the nations are enemies? I also, with my brethren and my servants, am lending them money and grain. Please let us stop this usury. So Nehemiah was guilty also. He was doing it. And he called everybody together and he says, this is evil, this is wrong, we have to stop. Verse 11, restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses. Also, a hundredth of the money and the grain, the new wine and the oil, that you have charged them. 1/100 was the usury. 1% was enough for them to steal everything from the people. And Nehemiah said, this is evil. It's wrong. We got to restore them on top of restoring their lands, their children, and everything else. We got to restore back to them the 1% interest that we used to steal it all in the first place. Verse 12, so they said, we will restore it and will require nothing from them. We will do as you say. Then I called the priests and required an oath from them that they would do according to the promise. So he made the priests take an oath that they do what they promised. Verse 13. This ain't over yet. Then I took out of the fold of my garment and said, so may God shake out each man from his house and from his property who does not perform this promise. So he's calling them all as a witness in front of God. And if they don't do what they have just promised, that God would shake them out of their houses and destroy them. Even thus, may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the people of the assembly said, amen, and praised the Lord. And the people did according to the promise. So they actually did what they promised that they were supposed to do. But let me bring something back up to you. 1% was so evil that they were able to destroy the entire nation and steal everything from the people. Who's going to be in God's kingdom? Let's take a look at Psalms chapter 15, verse 1. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? So here it's asking the question, who's going to be able to be there? Who may dwell in your holy hill? He who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. He who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does any evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised. But he who honors those who fear the Lord, he who swears at his own hurt and does not change. And verse 5, he who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. Now, if charging usury is a sin, now here's where we go from preaching to meddling, okay? If charging usury is a sin, what about paying it? Well, it doesn't say that that's an actual sin, but it is a curse that will destroy you, your wives, your husbands, your children, and your children's children's children. What are you teaching your kids? Last week, I got a text from Mary. She was upset. She says, we live in Knox County in Tennessee. She says, Knox County just raised the appraisals on all of the properties an average of 40%. So I answered her back and I said, yeah, I know. I had already got 4 letters in the mail listing our new appraisals. And see what's happening. This is planned. This isn't just by accident. It's not Putin's fault. It's not, you know, they have done this and they have planned this. Who makes out when inflation eats everything up? Who makes out the best?
BlackRock.
The government makes out the best. First thing they do is they go around and people say, wow, I have so much equity in my house. You know, a $30,000 house in California that you could buy for $30,000 in 1980 is close to $500,000 today. And people are fleeing that state. Like William, they're not here today. They're over. First time he came to church, I started talking to him, and I told him, I said, you don't talk like somebody from California. What caused you, or why did? What was your motivation from moving from California to Tennessee? He said, we didn't move. We fled. But see, people around here, they don't like that because people are leaving California and they come down here and they got all kinds. It's still a $30,000 house. It's just now you got to pay $500,000 for it. And it's not even realistically worth the $30,000 anymore because now there's 40-some years of wear and tear on it and things are wore out. And if you haven't gutted it and done a complete reno, it needs it now. And it's going to cost you far more than $30,000 to do that. You can ask Frank. You can't even buy the material for that kind of money. But anyhow, so then they come different states. A lot of them go to Texas. The ones that come here, they got lots of money. And they're coming in here right now and they're buying and they're making offers. $30,000, $20,000 over asking price and driving the prices up here. And the government loves it because now the values of they're coming by and they're reassessing. Every 5 years they reassess here. And now they've raised up all my properties. An average, and some of them was they doubled, but it's not worth double. It's just the money ain't worth anything anymore. I got one house. I paid $22,400 for it. I put about $18,000 into it, and they appraised that one for $149,000. Well, yeah, that's the whole point. They're going to tax you on $149,000, you know, and all of them have gone crazy. And then the insurance scams make it easy. You got a $100,000 house. You buy it, so you put $100,000 of insurance on it. I was going through this. I used to sell insurance. I was going through this the other day with Archer, kind of warning him for his house. So if a fire comes along and burns your house down to the ground, you say, well, at least I got $100,000 I can collect. I can get something for my contents and what. Wrong. Now, even if you bought that house last year, now that they've upped the appraisals by 40%, and they say, well, now your house is worth $140,000. And now you file your claim with the insurance company, and they've got a little loophole in there. They say you are underinsured.
Yes.
So you only had 60% of the insurance, which means you were only paying 60% of your premiums. Now you've got a total loss. We will pay you 60% of your policy. And there's this whole line of things like that that happens. It's called trickle-down theory, maybe. You know, I've heard that somewhere before. It trickles down and everybody is peeing on you. And cars, people, you know, we just got to have cars. So we got to, and everybody, most people need a car to go to work. But do you really need
an electric car?
Well, forget about the electric cars. They don't exist without the government subsidies, which means they steal money from everybody to subsidize somebody that wants to buy a coal-fired electric vehicle that they plug into the coal plant and for now. But anyway, so debt or usury is a system of slavery, which is what I tried to show you. Like Israel of old, we've sold ourselves to our creditors and we are slaves. There are more and more people each month that are working from paycheck to paycheck. And if anything happens, somebody gets in a car accident and can't, mom or dad can't work for a while. Maybe it's even only 3 months, 6 months. The first month that goes by, they've got to choose, well, we can't make the house payment, or we can't make the car payment, or wow, groceries, they tell us that it's 8.4% inflation, but groceries have doubled in the last year. We can't afford no more steaks. We're going to have to eat ground turkey and make that stretch. The Federal Reserve System, the Illuminati, the Bilderbergers, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds. It's the bankers who control most of this world through debt money. And they're getting ready. They're working feverishly on their, what are they calling it? Fed coin. Oh, yeah, they call it the Great Reset. If you've never read about the Great Reset, go look that up. And not Google. You won't get the truth off of Google. Go to someplace like DuckDuckGo and do a search for the Great Reset, because Google censors it all. But they're working feverishly in this country on the Fed coin. That's what they're calling it. Because I don't think they're going to allow, unless they can take it over and control it, they're not going to allow Bitcoin and other, you know, digital currencies to exist where they can't regulate it and see every transaction that you do. How do you think when the mark of the beast comes, they can just flip a switch and you can't buy or sell? See, they're going to start with things the first, like anybody that gets a crazy check is on Medicare or Medicaid. You got to go down and get your vaccine. You got to go down and comply. You've got to wear your mask. You've got to, and whatever else that they dream up. This is all about control. And if you don't do it, we cut you off. That's coming. The vaccine isn't the mark of the beast, but the system that they're building to track all of this is the same system that will be used to control and keep track of who has the mark of the beast and who does not. I said I've been broke far more than I've had any kind of money. But my grandfather taught me when I was young, I was a teenager, that debt was dumb. I just wished I had listened to him for more than 50 years ago when he started to tell me about it when he was still alive. He explained to me that when you buy a house, You pay for three houses. You buy one for yourself and two for the bank. Most people don't realize that. They really don't. Mary used to process deals at a car dealership. Smart people would come in and they'd talk to the salesman and they'd say, "How much does that car cost?" And they'd negotiate the price. Dumb people, the average person, would come in and they wouldn't give you a price. They say, "We can get you into a vehicle like this for $400 a month. Does that work?" Nobody ever says $400 a month times 72 months. Let me see how much that actually is. They just, "Well, I don't think I can qualify." We can get you qualified. There were people buying brand new, at that time, I don't know, 15 plus years ago, brand new $50,000 and $60,000 BMWs on special financing, paying 28% interest. What? It's vanity, it's greed, and it's stupidity. You need a car to go to work, that's fine. I can tell you about some of the hoopties that I used to have. Probably the worst one I ever had, I went over and a friend of mine gave it to me. And when we went to his house to get it, he knew I needed a car. We went to his house to get it. He hands me a shovel and he says, "You see that radio antenna sticking out of the snow in the ditch?" I says, "Yeah." He says, "Dig the car out. The battery's probably frozen and dead." He says, "You dig the car out, and when you get ready, come back up and let me know, and we'll jump it off or do what we got." I says, "I got a bad battery that isn't froze. It won't hold a charge, but we'll put it in there, jump it, and you can take it home." That car was so nice. It was a Pinto. That car was so nice that Mary put cookie sheets under the driver's seat because it was like the Flintstones. You'd see there's a hole in it that big, just on the driver's side alone. And it was a little four-speed stick shift. And if I go over railroad tracks, the body would flex enough that it would pop it out of gear. I'm not making this up. But I didn't have no $50,000 BMW at 20%, 8% interest either. They would have lost me at the $400 a month point. You know, there's no $400 a month. There were months I didn't make $400. But anyway, get back. Yeah. But in the last 89 years, the dollar has had an average inflation rate from the last 89 years. Now, that's quite a bit of time. If you average out inflation, it's been 3.54% per year. And people say, 3.54? That's not too awful bad.
That's over 100%.
It's 2,111.57% increase. Let me say that again. 89 years at 3.54% is a cumulative price increase of 2,111.57% on what people would be happy and thrilled with 3.54% today. A dollar today only buys 4.521% of what it bought in 1933. 4.521, a little over 4.5% of what a dollar bought in 1933. When I said, now they started pedal to the metal wide open and they stole our gold, and I'm not going to get into the stuff about we're forbidden to deal with unequal weights and measures. Not enough time, and it's gone too long. I'm almost done. Today, at 8.54%, and it's really it's closer to 20, but let's just go with the government's lie. 8.54%. $1 today, what you buy today with $1, if that inflation rate holds steady, it'll take $1.09 next year. 1 year from now, almost 10%. 109 to buy what a dollar buys today. The American household today has an average debt of $145,000. I would have thought it was a lot more than that. But the average, that means some people have nothing. I'm not bragging or anything. I'm a slumlord, okay? I'm not some rich guy. But there's people like me in there, it's zero. And then there's other people in there, it's like $1.5 million just on their mortgage, plus their cars, plus their credit cards, plus everything else. But $145,000 today. But here's the kicker. In 2000, that's what, 22 years ago? Do you know what it was 22 years ago, the average household debt? $50,971. So it's almost tripled in 22 years, the amount of debt that people is in. This is the result of violating God's law. In 1976, America was the richest nation on the earth. Now, things really weren't all that great in 1976, but at that point, we were still the richest nation on the face of the earth. And then Senator William Proxmire from Wisconsin put in a bill, I don't remember the Senate number, but it took us, they had already stole the gold in 1933, and in 1971, took us off the gold, or the silver.
No,
it
was gold standard.
I'm not talking about the gold standard. I'm talking about you had a silver certificate, and you could walk in, and you could say, give me a dollar's worth of certificate, and that or silver. In 1933, up until then, you could buy it, do that with gold. I've got a gold certificate. I got a few silver certificates. And you can't do that with none of it now. So now we were in free fall, and nothing. It was all whatever we can trade it for, whatever we can snooker everybody else into thinking what that value is. That's what we say it is. But we've gone from the biggest and the richest, not the biggest, but the richest nation on the face of the earth to the biggest deadbeat, bankrupt, broke, we will never recover in the entire world in that short amount of time. I'll show you one little thing here. Here's an inflation rate formula. How you calculate inflation. Now, I'm not saying everybody's got to learn how to do all this, okay? But the bottom line, read the bottom line. Therefore, $100 in 2000 has the same purchasing power of $144.59 in 2018, before they really went nuts and started handing out all of the scamulous money to the people and just about doubled our debt with scamulous money. All right, so the Bible tells us that hard times are coming to the world. I think this country will fall, like I said, just like ancient Rome fell. You know what was one of the final and the biggest reasons that the Roman government collapsed? When the people realized that they could gift themselves free corn. The money was devalued. They had military problems with sneak attacks. All of the stuff we're going through now, and it brought down the Roman Empire, what they say was the greatest. You know, Rome would never fail. And so let me ask you the question while I'm finishing up here. Are we good stewards? Isn't there a biblical precedent that we're supposed to be good stewards? Now, if you're $145,000 in debt, you can't wake up tomorrow morning and say, you know what? I'm going to go down to the bank and I'm going to pay that sucker off. It takes some severe life-changing instances to do that. You got to ask yourself, do I need this $80,000 BMW? Do I even need a $40,000? I don't know, what can you get for $40,000 anymore? I don't know, not much. Nissan Altima, they're probably worth, cost more than that. Or maybe I'll downgrade from the BMW, maybe I'll get a Prius. I can't afford a Tesla, but I'll get a Prius.
Yeah, Prius is a good little car.
What do we teach our children? What are we teaching our kids? And our grandchildren. What kind of example are we setting for them? And what can we do for ourselves today, no matter what our personal finances are? Are we at anything like Joseph? And I'm not saying we got to go to the end of the world and we got to prepare and we got to, you know, put in a bunker in our property and hide it up in the woods somewhere and we've got to. But the shape that the average person in the church is in today, when things come down, like you have to sin, or we cut you off and you're going to starve. See, that's what my heart's going out. What do you think most people will do? Sin. Sin. There are people, and somebody was talking about it up here. They had a brother, a father, somebody that was in the hospital. And they told him, you can't come in the hospital and visit your brother because you're not vaccinated. Well, I didn't have a choice. I had to go see my brother. So I took the vaccinations. Now, if somebody wants a vaccination, hey, go get one. Go get one. Nobody ever says, dang, you're kidding me. Well, let me start calling other hospitals out there and seeing if there's one that'll let me come visit my brother. Because I'm the one that's got to take care of him because he's all I got. So we got to get in there and make sure they don't kill him. And we'll get him transferred to a hospital that doesn't require this. Do you have a plan? See, I told you I was going to talk about today about one of the things I want to do one of the evenings. I asked Brenda, it's got to be at least 15 years ago since we've done this. Everybody knows how to can food, right? Pressure cooker with a canner. I didn't know. I saw my grandma do it. You know, I saw her doing it growing up. I had no clue. Well, about 15 years ago, we brought, I think the Alts brought theirs and we brought ours, and there was three or four canners, and we took an afternoon and we taught everybody how to can food. The way meat and chicken is going up so crazy, nutso, I brought my pressure cooker, and if we don't do it here, we're going to do it when we get home. I'm going to can some meat and some chicken. And so if somebody wants to know, how do you do this? I looked at the price of a brand new pressure cooker. They're $89. Next week, they're probably $95. The week after that, they're $107. But $89.90 at Walmart on Friday. Okay? The quart, wide mouth, canning jars. Can't remember. They were like... No, not no more. When's the last time you bought them? I think I paid $16.99 or $17.99 for a case of 12. Which really sucked because we've got 100 or 150 of them out in one of my sheds, but I'd have to clean them. I'd have to go get new lids and rings. And so let's just go buy a quart.
Sandy. It's real hard to find lids. It is. They're putting them with the jar. Yeah.
There was lids and rings available at Ace Hardware, at Walmart, and at Rural King, the three stores. I had to go to... four stores actually to get the quart wide mouth canning jars because Ace didn't have them, Walmart didn't have them, and Rural King didn't have them. The fourth place, no, I went to Tractor Supply, they didn't have them, but you know, the fourth place, the grocery store, Ingles, they had them. So we bought a case on Thursday night. But see, I'm not talking about putting it up for 5 years, 10 years, 15. I'm talking about let's buy it today and can it, and next year when a pound of chicken breast, instead of being whatever it is, $2.99, which I think is more than that, it's not going to be $2.99. It's going to be $5.99 or $6.99. So we pull it off the shelf and we eat it then. But does anybody want to learn how to can food? One afternoon. If you do, we can can it. Now, Mary and I got some plans, and somebody else here, because it's being taped, they're not going to... But what about freeze-dried foods? Oh, I've been lusting after one. You call it freeze porn, you know? I've been... Harvest Right, yeah. Somebody here has one. And I'm going to get me one, but even that, when you preserve the food, you don't lose any of the nutrients from the heat. So you retain 100% of the nutrients, the enzymes, things like that. Closer to four. But do you have a plan? What happens if you're hurt and you can't work? Are you living paycheck to paycheck? What happens if the government tells you, you will comply or you will starve and die? Where are you in the 3 years with Pharaoh's plan? They haven't flipped the trigger yet, but they're on the verge of flipping it right now. You want to talk about things one evening, what we can do. Yeah, we'll mix a little bit of medical if that's what somebody wants. Or we'll forget it and talk 100% about this. Last thing I wanted to leave you with, Albert Einstein. Smart guy, right? Compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. He who understands it earns it. He who doesn't pays it. If I got one plea for everybody, you got to start somewhere. Get out of debt. Get out of debt.
If you can't afford it, don't buy it.
Yeah, if you can't afford cash. I stopped being broke when I stopped borrowing money. Now, I'm not rich. Don't get me wrong. I'm a slumlord, okay? People say, well, how are you going to buy a house? Well, if you're making $50,000 a year and you're spending $50,000 a year, the only way to do it is to bow down to the bankers and pay them the usury and pay the and suffer the curse. But if you're making $50,000 a year and you decide, I'm going to sell the cars, the new cars, pay off the debts, and going to get a little whoopty to drive around, I'm going to go down and get a $5,000 Dave Ramsey car. Okay, which is still a kind of halfway decent car. It'll get you to work and back and forth. Your coworkers aren't going to say, nice car. Where'd you get that? They might actually come up and say, is everything okay? What happened to your nice car? And people say, don't you talk to my husband about doing that. Or don't you talk to my wife. You know how long I've worked for that $80,000 quad cab Cummins diesel Dodge pickup, 3/4 ton pickup? I deserve that. I'll take you outside and I'll show you my 2,307,000 mile van sitting out there. And how many hundreds of thousands are?
45,099.
Frank can show you his 99 3/4 ton Ford quad cab pickup that's got 349,000 miles on, and it works just fine. He got in it and drove all the way down here. Do you got a plan? Is there something you can do? If you don't know where to start, I'm going to try and find it somewhere. I saved it, but in one of the newsletters I get every month, the thing was $5 extra a week. So now it's going to be at least $10 extra because it's at least a year too old. Going down to Dollar General and buying $5 worth of canned food and stuff like that for a year. And I think if you did that, it was like a 3-month supply if you got hurt or you couldn't work or you got laid off or lose your job. Now, I'm not promoting the Mormons, but if you can't do anything, there's Mormon canneries all over the country. You can't buy food cheaper than from the Mormons. Go down to the Mormons and get some food. We'll talk about it. So let me ask, do people want to get together and discuss some of these things? Because I've already gone too long. All right. Does anybody want to learn how to can food? All right. Okay. All right, so we'll take one afternoon. We'll figure out when it is. And, man, you guys are leaving tomorrow, though. We can't do it tonight. Let me think on that for a minute. But anyhow, okay, we might turn it off for some parts of it, but we'll record most of it. All right. I can't fix this for everybody. It's not that I don't want to. I would love to. See, I don't even play the lottery. But, you know, I bought a ticket about 5 years ago, and I said, okay, God, if I'm supposed to win the lottery, whatever I win, I'm going to use it all for you. And I didn't win, and I lost $1 or $2, whatever that lottery ticket was. So I figured if he wanted me to win the lottery, he could have had me win the lottery.
$6
now, inflation. I can't fix it for everybody. And I can't pay off your house. I can't pay off your cars. I can't give you food in case you refuse to take the mark of the beast or a vaccination or they cut off your crazy check or you say when it comes to sin, make your choice. What do you want? And this is going to be extremely difficult for people that have health issues and health problems. I even see the time maybe before the government takes that step, if you got insurance through an employer or something, you're going to comply and you're going to do whatever it is that they tell you you're going to do, or they're going to take your insurance away. You say, well, I got to have the insurance. I'm not saying it's easy, but when it comes to sin or lose it. I hope nobody has to make that choice. But there will be people making that choice. I can't fix it. I can't even fix it for myself. Much less, you know, I've had plans for 20 years to go put solar panels up and other things, and I still got plans, but there's somebody here that's living off the grid, and they got lights in their house when they come home and turn the lights on, and their refrigerator runs, and they're actually doing it. Last year he put on a little presentation about it. But look at what happened with Pharaoh and everybody. It wasn't just the surrounding nations. The Egyptians, in 3 years, Pharaoh had everything. Make a plan. You're going to have to depend on God. If you think you can take care of it yourself, guess what? He's going to let you try. Okay? But just like when you're cut, say you cut your arm and you're bleeding, and what do? Do you say, hey, somebody grab my arm, put some pressure on it, and let's pray and ask God to heal it? Or do you say, Father, if you want this wound to be healed, please heal me, and if not, I'll see you when I hear the trumpet blown. You know, you do what you can. What if Joseph didn't do it, what he was supposed to do? What if Nehemiah didn't do what he was supposed to do? Get up and tell the people, stop this evil and stop this sinning. You do what you can, and you rely on God for the rest. That's where the plan starts. That's step number one. What can I do? Am I praying every day to ask God to help me, to give me wisdom, to give me the knowledge to know what's right for me? And then the biggest obstacle is spouses, because you're going to have to get on the same page if anything's going to happen. And then even if the spouses agree, your children. When you tell them, say, you know, we really don't need 5 cell phones. We don't need a $300 a month cell phone plan. And we don't need a $250 a month cable television plan. And, you know, when you leave the room, shut the lights off. Anybody that grew up that's over 40 years old, I guarantee you, were you born in a barn? Shut the door. Or somebody comes in and says, who's got all the lights on in the house? Turn the lights off. Do you think money grows on trees? You know, there's generations of people that have not even had that concept explained to them. And they will rebel. But you got to get it right with God first, before you make any decision. Before you talk to your spouse, you got to get it right between you and God and get prayed up before you even talk to the spouse. Because I'll tell you what, I hated living paycheck to paycheck. And that's when it was good times, when I had a paycheck to live from paycheck to paycheck. And it is very calming, and you get a lot of peace to know that you don't have to worry about the banker coming and taking your house away the first time something happens. This place here lost almost half of their property this spring through no fault of their own, other than they were stupid and went out and got a bunch of debt. But the business that 2 businesses, one their water plant, and second one, the renting these places. COVID killed the rentals, and the water plant, Mike told everybody yesterday what happened with that. This isn't, Daniel's the guy that some of you met, Daniel, it's his father that started this. Frank, you saw, I lived in Wisconsin, I went through it. Back in the 80s, the family farms, 2-3 generations, and the government hoodwinked people into debt, and debt was the single biggest problem. And you had multiple generation family farms that were foreclosed and lost.
Yeah,
the dairy business. Yep. In Montana, South Dakota, all over the country. You got to get a plan. So, yeah. Let me all know. We'll figure out what day for canning and what day for talking about what we can do. But even if you can, scrape up $5 a week, you can start to do something. That's what I'll leave you with. And if you can't, figure out a way to make a trade with somebody that has an extra $5 a week. You say, hey, if I do this for you, can you just, when you go to the store, can you do this, you know, $5 or $10 a week? Pretty much everybody can do everything. And if it is a widow or somebody that we're responsible for, do it for them. And if you can't do it for them, let's get together with others that can.